Wait for it, wait for it, and we're live. Hey, all you crazy sci-fi and fantasy fans, it's time for your daily dose of shenanigans over here at the Blasters and Blades podcast. Just a couple of nerdy veterans and one absentee chaos coordinator who's out cooking dinner, so we salute you, Madam Stabby Stab, geeking out over our science fiction passions and fantastical fantasies. A place where magic is king, the sky is the limit, and space is the place. We are the podcast that puts the fun in dysfunction. So without further ado, we're going to let our guest, Miss Melissa McShane, introduce herself to our listeners and viewers at home.
Hi, I'm Melissa McShane. I write fantasy novels. I have published over 50 novels in the last, well, I don't know how long I've been doing this, but it's been a while. I live out in the western United States in the shadow of the mountains, and currently, that's where my home is, but currently I live in Kerala, India, which is in the southwest corner of India, and it is beautiful. They call it God's country, and I totally believe it. So that's my introduction, I guess. What else do you want to know?
That works. I mean, unless you like long walks on the beach, up pyramids or something, I don't know.
It also depends on what God they're talking about.
Well, that's just it. In Kerala, the religious divisions are about a third Muslim, a third Hindu, and a third Catholic. So they call it God's country, and nobody ever argues about which God they mean, which I find interesting.
That is very interesting.
Really peacefully.
As an amateur anthropologist, that is very interesting, because usually somebody takes over, and you got Muslims, Hindi, and Catholics there, and you figured that is a start to a really bad joke on an argument.
You'd think, but I think that the presence of a third party keeps the other two from fighting with each other. So they tend to all celebrate, they don't celebrate each other's religious holidays in the sense of they all worship the same, but for example, the end of Ramadan is a holiday for everyone. Everybody gets off work. They all recognize Christmas, even though for most of them, it's mostly a shopping opportunity. The same with most of the Indian, the Hindu and Muslim holidays.
Okay.
But they all get along really well. My husband's company, which is why we're there. One of the employees, his daughter was being christened. And it was the Hindu friends who arranged for the christening gift and going to the party and everything. So it's remarkable. It's really remarkable.
It's just great to see people getting along. You know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One of the things I learned when I got back from Iraq is how much of what people consider of Muslim culture is actually a fusion of the religion in the region. And so I started just because I wanted to know more. And I started talking to people that were Muslim, but from other parts of the world, and their interpretation of the faith was vastly different. Yeah. And it got me curious because, you know, everyone assumes the religion is the religion, and you don't realize how much of a factor like the local culture plays into it. And then it got me thinking, I wonder how much of that applies to every other religion too. Probably a lot. I wonder if they practice their Christianity a little bit differently than what they might in Southern Alabama or, I don't know, Washington State or, you know, insert different location.
I'm
sure that Catholicism is. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I was raised Catholic. I'm a devout Catholic. Two of my best friends were my interpreters in Iraq who were devout Muslims, and we get along famously. Obviously, we couldn't stay in Iraq after the war. We all petitioned to bring them back. So they're American citizens now, but we still, it's a really interesting dynamic, especially as, like I said, my minor is the anthropology of religion. And we talk about these things, and we talk about more things that we have in common than we don't, you know? So it's a really interesting dynamic.
You have to ask the most important religion question of them all. Pineapple on pizza, yay or nay?
Yes. Absolutely. I'm sorry, guys.
You got to have jalapenos on the pineapple pizza with
Canadian jalapenos. Absolutely. Absolutely. Jalapenos are important.
Otherwise, the pineapple on pizza dynamic doesn't work. It falls apart on its own. You throw the jalapenos on there and you got the
pineapple. Really well.
You got the Canadian bacon. It's nirvana on a slice. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Like, one of the great things about living in India is you can get jalapenos on practically anything. And really? We get, yeah, jalapenos on my favorite pizza there. And another great thing about living in Kochi in Kerala is that there is a lot, there's a big international food scene. So you can get pretty much anything. It's not just Indian food. And my favorite pizza has tomatoes and corn and jalapenos and mozzarella cheese and green peppers. And I think it has black olives too. I can't remember. We try a lot.
I don't know if I'm sold on the corn. I might have to try that here at home.
The corn is different. Yeah, it's really different. There's a little crunch to it. If you don't like corn, it probably isn't a draw. Like if you hate corn, but if you love corn, it's a really good addition.
Sis, I live in Southern California. I love elotes. Yeah. I love elotes. We just made that a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. We made some homemade elotes, and oh, it was divine. Mm-hmm. With the tahine and some of the citrus flavor in that, and then we put some lemon squeezes on top of that. Oh my God. I'm thinking about it. I'm ending this podcast. I'm going to go eat some.
The next introduction, dear listeners, how we found them. So we have to blame Jenna Brown for this one. So if you love her, Jenna gets all the credit. And if you hate her, well, Jenna gets all the credit. It's all Jenna's fault.
And all the hate mail goes to Stabby anyway. So
yeah. And all the hate mail goes to Stabby. But for once, it's not Nick's fault.
Okay.
It'll still end up being my fault.
Well, I mean, that's between you and your wife. But for me, it's not your fault today.
Just me so and the clear. Viewers, too.
True. So the next part of the introduction, dear listeners, a religion question. But she's been on before, so we're going to mix it up just for funsies. So are you ready for this?
All right. I'm ready.
Stargate, Lost in Space, or Warehouse 13?
Warehouse 13. Yeah.
Excellent choice. Amanda Tapping. Amazing.
Of course, you put the one series I haven't watched yet, but I've heard good things.
Which one have you watched? A lot of fun.
You haven't watched Warehouse 13?
I have not. Eventually, I'll get to it because doing this podcast over the last 3 years, I've been exposed to so much that I'm so far behind in.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could just spend the next decade just catching up for the 80s, 90s, and early.
But you know what I'm not going to be doing in the meantime? Drawing awesome comic books. Stabby has actually said, like, you know what? What if you got hit with the stroke by God's divine? Because we're both devout Catholics, so everything has a plan, right? Mm-hmm. So she's like, what if God's plan was you haven't been working enough on your freaking comic books, so I'm gonna hit you with a stroke, but I'm gonna keep your right hand intact. Your right hand's gonna be perfectly fine. Everything else is gonna be affected, but your right hand's gonna be good to go. So now you can work on the comics because you don't go back to work until late June, early July. You got time. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even think about it that way. I just kind of thought I was smited, you know, but she's right. So, but here's where I get the mix. I put a TV with streaming services hooked up to Wi-Fi right above where I draw in the office. So I can put these movies on, I can put these shows on and kind of catch up while I'm working on comics.
Oh, that's great.
Speaking of catching up, we've got more religion questions.
Right.
Polytheistic, Beowulf, the 13th Warrior, or Beastmaster?
Oh, you know, the 13th Warrior.
Excellent choice. The speech in there, the mead. And he's the reason that movie's the reason I've wanted to try mead.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I tried mead because of that movie.
I haven't found any that I liked, but then I talked to Hillbilly, who runs the Three Ravens. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, mead is like wine. Just because you tried one doesn't mean you've tried them all. They're not like a universal flavor. Oh. I mean, beer is pretty universal. There's a similarity between all of them.
And it's there's not some regional stuff, too.
Yeah, but I mean, it's you can pretty much have an idea if you like beer if you've tried one, generally speaking, if it's a quality beer. Like, I'm not talking like Budweiser or something, but just in general, that is not true of mead because there's so many varieties for the mead.
Yeah.
So I'm going to definitely try more. Maybe I can peer pressure him into sending us some.
I had a raspberry mead that was delightful and it was out of Italy.
Ooh, nice.
Which was weird. I'm like, Italian mead. Okay, let's do this. And I tried it and I was like, oh man, I felt like I was a connoisseur. I'm like, oh, I'm definitely getting the raspberry. I'm getting these notes so here,
fancy,
too. I'm
yes.
like, I was like, I felt like I should be wearing a suit and a tie, you know, or a bow tie and a tux, whatever. No, meat's good. Big fan.
All right. And we'll have to try it out. But before we move on, madam, favorite dinosaur?
Oh, gosh. Well, now I'm only thinking about Stegosaurus because that's what we talked about before. So there's another one. And I can't remember the name of it, so I'm going with Stegosaurus. But there was one that my kids identified for me because I bought, I got a miniature. I paint miniatures. And in my miniatures advent calendar, there was a dinosaur warrior with a big head. And so I showed it to my kids, and they figured out what it was. And I can't remember the name of it now. So that would be my actual favorite. But, you know, I love the Stegosaurus.
So let's back up for a second. You paint miniatures. Tell us more.
Yes, I do.
Are you a Warhammer?
Okay, so no, I'm not into Warhammer because I'm not a masochist and I'm not a millionaire. So I only just went to, there's a Warhammer store about 2 miles from my house in Utah. And I went there for the first time in December of last year. And we lived in that house for, it's been now 14 years, and I had never been to the Warhammer store, but I needed paint. And so I went in there. I've been painting miniatures for maybe 25 years and on and off. I'm not great at it. I'm still learning. I think, and you probably say that about, you know, everyone who has a hobby, you're always learning. But I like painting monsters. My hands shake a little bit too much to be good at faces on humanoids, so I try to avoid those and I go for the monstrous. I have a Kraken that I painted. And
do you say Kraken or Kraken?
I say Kraken because I spoke German in college, and so You see what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah,
so
no, I was Kraken. Thinking like, now I'm picturing like the Kraken, but with a crocodile head.
Oh, that's even better. Anyway, I have one of those, and I have a Cthulhu, and just a whole bunch of miniatures that, you know, show my growing skills, I hope. But
do you use the magnifying glass for the fine details?
I don't. I can. I have a beautiful magnifying glass that my father gave me. On a nice heavy weighted base, but I never remember to get it out. And most of what I do, I'm working on really large models, so it's not as necessary as it is for the smaller ones where you really need to see the detail. I have I am into Reaper miniatures. The Reaper company has got all my money, and they do Kickstarters every now and then, and I spend a lot, and then I have a pile of shame that I have not painted.
So do you actually game with these miniatures, or do you just collect
them? We used to. Then when we went to mostly because of COVID, but also because there are so many good online options for role-playing games. Like we use Fantasy Grounds, but there's also Roll20 and things like that, where my husband was our GM for a long time, and he got tired of hauling the miniatures around. So he kind of pushed for us to move to a virtual role-playing setup. And that means I have all these miniatures that I no longer have a use for, except that they're cute and I like them. So I decorate with them.
Nice. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So, because we are no longer knuckle-dragging troglodytes, but we are civilized human beings, coffee or tea?
Hey, I said neither coffee nor tea. I drink hot chocolate. I drink it as dark as you can get it, with no cream or sugar added, just nice. And so it's like coffee, I guess, because it's bitter if you drink black coffee. But it's chocolate instead. So that's what I drink.
I was hoping you would change your mind. So what is popular where you're at in India? What are they drinking?
Tea is very popular. In fact, the building where my husband works is full of young professionals, and on the seventh floor of their building is a big cafeteria area, but instead of selling food at lunchtime, they produce tea at 4 o'clock. And so you go in and you can get tea and you can get snacks and you can get like fruit, and they have an ice cream place. And that's their popular beverage is tea. They also do drink coffee, but they, I haven't really noticed them, you know how like for us, you take your coffee into work and you have that in the morning. And I haven't really noticed that as much with the Indians. But that could just be because my husband working, because he has to have contact with his office here in the U.S., he works from noon until like 10 in the evening. And so I don't see them in the morning. So I could be wrong, but okay. It really is more tea. Yeah.
Okay. That's fair. No, it's, so we apologize a little bit of the connection issues, dear listener, but, you know, the internet is what the internet is, and she's coming from a long distance away, so lots of mice and hamsters are running on their wheels to power this for us today, so we just salute the war hamsters that keep this show going.
That's right.
War hamsters for war masters.
There you go. If you had a question that you put in the side chat, if you wanted to answer before we dove into the book that brought us?
Yeah, I mean, I figured this would have been I was going to let you talk a little bit more and then throw this question in, but we'll throw it in now. How long have you been in India?
Just over a year. We moved in January of 2022.
So being immersed in that culture and being a writer, is that something that you want to throw into later stories or, you know, potentially like different universes or different stories? That's something you'd want to use creatively later on.
Yeah. I'm currently writing the seventh book in the War Master series, and they go to the southern end of their continent. And I just basically made it Kerala, India. They have, it's fantasy world. So I had to adapt a little, but there's things like nothing gets going before 10 o'clock in the morning. And then they eat late and they stay up late because that's when it's cooler. There are in Kochi there, well, in all of India, but in Kochi, there are these little three-wheeled vehicles called tuk-tuks. And my theory is that they are called tuk-tuks because that's the sound the engine makes. I don't know if that's true, but I like that explanation. And they're just these little cabs, and you can flag them down and you get a cheap ride pretty much anywhere. What else did I use? I used all the food that I like. I put that into the book. I put in some of the cultural things that hospitality is really important to them. And they, when we were first there, the owners of the company were showing us around. They took us to this really popular vacation spot that's up in the hills, and to a resort. They took us on houseboat rides. They just did everything they could, and they still are doing everything they can to make us comfortable. I mean, everybody is so friendly and so helpful. And it's good that we are visibly different from them, because they know that we're guests and they know that we don't understand, and they go out of their way to help us figure things out. And I think it's the best foreign living experience you could have, honestly, because almost everybody speaks some English. A lot of them are taught English when they're very young, and they're taught to think it. So most of them speak idiomatic English. And the exchange rate is really favorable to Americans. So we can live very comfortably. And like I say, everybody's just really friendly. So I took all of that and I'm putting it into this book. And it's so fun. It's really fun to be able to take advantage of this experience that I'm having and put it into fiction, even though none of them will ever read this book, because fantasy, like, they don't do fantasy. India is the land that fantasy forgot. And they are very into action, adventure, and romance, but all contemporary.
They do sci-fi in India, too. So, I'm pretty sure
they do. They do, but it's not in terms of fiction, in terms of what they read.
Right.
They like science fiction. They like fantasy epics if they're historical, so in film. And I did find it's a fantasy trilogy. There's an author who writes fantasy, and he's apparently doing very, very well. But it's all grounded in Hindu mythology. So it's kind of an interesting question. Is it really fantasy if it's part of their religion and they believe that it's, you know, that this is something they believe? So it becomes an interesting question of what, you know, fantasy looks like, because to me, I'm not Hindu. So to me, it's all entirely a fantasy story. And for them, it's more historical fantasy, like, you know, based on parts of their religion and then sort of elaborated on. So,
yeah, get that. One of my best friends immigrated from India to the United States when he was 9. And I hit him up all the time. I'm like, hey, man, I want to throw some Hindi gods into my universe. Can you help me out? And this dude is tatted out like he's like MS-13. Like, first Indian person I've ever seen that has like this type of, like, well, be tattooed at all. Mm-hmm. Usually all the ones I've met have like virgin skin, as we call it in the culture. And he's got an owl on his neck. And I've asked him all about his tattoos. He's got stuff with Kali, you know, and all the other deities and stuff like that. And like, it's almost like a religious text tattooed on him. I'm like, dude, like, help me out here, man. He's like, oh, no, I got you. And then he's like, he'll give me the rundown. I'm like, I didn't know that there was so much light and dark. I guess most religions would have that dichotomy of light and dark. But like, when he tells me stories from his culture, I'm just like, oh shit, I forgot my pen. I should be writing this.
Yeah.
We actually recently reviewed Tollywood, because of the language, but we've done the 3 Rs movie, which should have aired before this one does. You could tell we record out of order, dear listener. But it's been like, when you want to do something that's slightly different, like the way they're making movies, that alone, I mean, Nick and I definitely decided we're going to do more of those, because that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh, and speaking of tattoos, I have seen several Indians with tattoos. They are all stylists at my hair salon, and They're all male. Everybody at the hair salon, all the stylists are male. The guy who does the pedicures is male. It was really different because in the U.S., almost all the stylists I've known have been women. So it was unusual, and yet, you know, no big deal. I keep meaning to ask Ashish if this was what he always wanted to do, or if he kind of fell into it, but I forgot this last time. So, but he has a tattoo. Several of them have tattoos.
Nice. I wish I could cut hair. I got tattoos.
Yeah, see, it qualifies you, obviously.
Obviously. Fit right in. I just need to learn how to cut hair.
Before we dive into the book that brought us here, let's talk about the genre, because you're writing lit RPG, and we haven't done a lot of that.
Yeah.
And we recently interviewed the Hollows, Jacob and Heather, for their less safe for work version, although we kind of skirted around the issues. But I didn't realize how much stuff was there in that genre. Like, I think lit RPG, and you think the light novels that are popular overseas, but I didn't realize how much the American audience had sort of glommed onto that and how many options there were. I'm fascinated. I'm gonna start buying all the
JR, books. You need to explain what lit RPG is, because in my mind, I'm thinking choose your own adventure.
Nope.
So lit RPG is, if I understand it, the premise is the main character gets sucked into the game, sort of like Ready Player One.
Sort of.
Oh, okay. Like Jumanji.
Do you want me to explain it?
Absolutely.
Yes, please.
All right. Okay. So lit RPG, and there's offshoots of it, but in general, lit RPG is a story where the game mechanics of the world are explicit. So sometimes it is in a computer RPG, sometimes it's a tabletop RPG. Often the main character is from our world and is transported to the game world. That's not always the case, but it is the most common. We call that isekai, which is Japanese for, I think, different world is what it literally means. I could be wrong, so listeners, please correct me. I don't actually remember what it's for. But isekai refers to someone from our world being transported into another game world. So the point of the lit RPG is that you get character sheets, you get stats, you get skills, you get leveling up, you get monsters with statistics, and that is all on the page. And the degree to which that is on the page varies according to the author, and people have different preferences. So you have some that is just barely lit RPG, where the stats are minimal and not referred to, and then you go all the way to the other extreme where you've got pages and pages of stat blocks and leveling up and hit points and things like that. So it varies. Mine tend to be a little closer to the lighter side of things. There's still statistics and stuff, but I don't write them out very often.
Is that mainly for the reader, or the characters involved in the book, are they also aware of the stats and that they're in a game?
Yes, the characters are aware of the stats. They're conscious of, they know and have access to their statistics and to other like monsters. And then there are dungeons that they can explore. Sometimes the dungeon is the main character. There are lots of variations on this, but basically it is the characters being conscious of and the statistics being an explicit part of the world.
Now, do the other
really cool
the player character, the main characters you're reading about, they would know, but do the other characters in the world, the NPCs as it were, are they aware they're in a game, or are they living like it's their real life?
No, it's not even really a game, because it is the real world. It's just gamified. So sometimes they're pulled into the world. A lot of that is, there are some, it's not as popular anymore, but VR game that you can't get out of is one variation on lit RPG. So you're in the game literally. In others, it's a game world, but it is the world. It's not actually a game to anyone who's in it. So the NPCs know, they're conscious of the game world. A lot of the time you'll get main characters who are transported into this world, and then only some of the people they encounter are player characters, and the rest are NPCs, and the degree to which they know what's going on varies.
Okay. So it really depends on the way the author tells a story, because there doesn't seem to be a hard and fast rule there.
Not really.
Is there a difference between the lit RPG, game lit, isekai, and all the other variations of that kind of genre?
There are discussions, sometimes arguments, about whether something is lit RPG or game lit. Whether lit RPG tends to be the big umbrella term, and then gamelit is a subcategory of that. Isekai is a type of story that can be applied to anything. So it's like it's more like, is this a VR story? Is this an isekai story? Is this, I don't know what else. There's other variations, but in general, it's lit RPG and then gamelit. But there are people who will argue the point as to which is which. I'm not sure it matters from my perspective, because I think you get a good story, you get something that enjoying, and it doesn't really matter what category it falls into.
Yeah, I know there was some lawsuits with some of the names for the various fields within this space where someone tried to trademark it. I remember a couple years ago that was a big thing, but I didn't follow it because I didn't know enough about it to know that it sounded interesting. Mm-hmm. If we hadn't known the Hollows and they hadn't told us what they were doing, it probably wouldn't even occur to me that, hey, this actually sounds fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of glad we agreed to do that interview because Now I'm like, huh, what else is out there? Maybe we can read about war hamsters. I mean, war masks.
I think that's probably one of the best things that we get to experience and have in doing this show is we get exposed to new things, new literary ideas, new story ideas. And like I said, since I've been on this thing going on 3 years now, my library has increased. My bank account has decreased, you know, as I learned about all this stuff, you know. And it's made me a more advent reader, you know. Like, I didn't read a whole lot of books before that. I read comic books all the time because I'm a comic book guy. But getting to interview authors like yourself and like the Hollows and all these great people that we've had on this show, I've been exposed to new avenues of entertainment, which has just been amazing. I have no regrets.
So how did you discover the genre? Because, I mean, you went from what you were doing, paranormal romance, right?
No, not paranormal romance. I'm just doing straight up fantasy. But all right. So what happened was in, like, I think 2017, I wrote a series called Company of Strangers. And that was based on my desire to always wanted to write a series or a book or something about characters who were adventurers going on quests like you do in a role-playing game. So okay. I didn't know about Lit RPG at the time. This was just a fantasy world that was strongly informed by my long history of playing role-playing games. And I didn't know what Lit RPG was until a friend of mine who was, he's not really writing Lit RPG, but it's flavored that way. So there's still statistics and stuff, but it's not quite the same. Anyway, he introduced me to an anime called The Rise of the Shield Hero. And I fell in love with that. I adore it. It's wonderful. Flaws with the second season aside. And so that was my introduction to the concept of isekai and game worlds and explicit statistics and things like that. And from there, I started looking at fiction, lit RPG. So, you know, you have light novels, and then what most people are doing now in the field is more fiction than light novel. My husband is the real reader. He is, he's the one who'll read stuff and then, like, tell me, oh, I think you'd like this one. And so, because I'm not reading as much as he is, writing kind of takes up a lot of time. But but that's how I found out about it.
You said your friend introduced you to a series and then your mic dropped for a second. So we didn't hear what that series was.
Oh, sorry. Oh, the series is The Rising of the Shield Hero. And it's an anime series and a light novel series. And I assume a web novel originally. But it's about a guy who is isekai'd into a fantasy world as one of four legendary heroes, except he's the one they all hate. Like, he has this really bad reputation that he didn't earn personally, that his predecessors did. And so he starts off in the hole because nobody wants to group with him and they all assume the worst of him. And then he kind of works his way up to be a real hero and a better hero than the other three guys. So, and there's three seasons of it now. I'm still working my way through the third season. I just don't have time for watching stuff like I used to. But anyway, so I really enjoy that series.
Okay. And I will link that as a hashtag. So if you want to find it, you can look there, dear listener. All right, we're going to pause for a moment while we shamelessly shill for the man, and then we're going to jump into the series that brought us here, which is the Lit RPG series that had us talking about this in the lead up. So roll that beautiful footage.
Mythic heroes throughout history tamed creatures of lore to fight alongside them. Video games took up the mantle, and for decades, players adopted beasts for companions. Some had tigers. Others, lions. Dinosaurs. Some even had dragons. So when my consciousness was transferred into the most realistic virtual game ever created, I chomped at the bit, hoping to befriend a great beast to fight at my side. And what did I get? A porcupunk. Who needs a dragon anyway? Read a book.
All right. So first, for people who don't know who you are, could you give us real quick before we start talking about the War Master series, what series have you written? You have a list of them. What are you known for right now?
Okay. So my most popular, probably my most well-known series is The Last Oracle. It's contemporary fantasy about a young woman who takes a job with a bookstore that turns out to be an oracle. You go in, you ask a question, and the custodian picks a book that tells you the answer to your question you had to study. And I think contemporary fantasy is really big right now. People like reading about our world with a twist. So that's my most popular series. My other popular series is historical fantasy. It's called The Extraordinaries, and it features a bunch of women fighting the Napoleonic Wars with psychic powers. And the first one of that is called Burning Bright, and the main character is a pyrokinetic woman who fights pirates in the Caribbean Sea.
Nice.
Yeah.
Fire and boats tend not to go together, though. Sailors get superstitious about that.
That's right. Originally, when I planned the series, she was going to be in the army. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, there's more obvious conflict if she's on a ship because of exactly that, because sailors are superstitious. But it turns out the bad guys have pyrokinetics of their own. So fighting fire with fire, literally.
Nice. So when you say ships and then are you talking like clipper ships, ships of the line, you know,
ships,
what kind of
ship? Line? Okay. The ship that she's on is actually a frigate. So it's a smaller one, but we're not talking the enormous 72 cannon ships, but they are detailed to the Caribbean to fight pirates because the pirates are attacking the ships and drawing manpower away from where they are needed to fight Napoleon. And
so
that was
you have my attention, madam.
Oh yeah. And
we didn't know this was a historical piece.
Yes, like, this is historical.
You just gotta skip over this. Like, you didn't just say what you just said.
Oh yeah. It's historical fantasy.
If you wondered what happened if you added magic to Master and Commander, apparently it is this series.
That's exactly right. Yes.
What is the series name?
It's called The Extraordinaries. The first book is called Burning Bright.
All right. I am looking that up. I wonder if I can make this tax deductible. We'll find out. April's coming, people.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. That sounds interesting.
I'm not paying them this year.
Oh.
Yeah. Who needs to pay them? Like, they won't care. They'll never catch us.
All they do is cost me more money at the grocery store. I don't think they deserve my money.
No. Yeah.
So first, how did you come up with the concept for War Master?
Okay. Well, it was because I was reading Lit RPG, and it was so much like if I had known about Lit RPG in 2017, I probably would have made Company of Strangers that genre. And I'm glad I didn't, because what I came up with for Company of Strangers works really well for what it is. And so, but then I find out about Lit RPG. I'm thinking, you know, this is so much fun. I love this. I want to do some of this. And so I mentioned this to my husband at one of our lunches. And I said, okay, I really want to write one of these. And the only idea I have is that I want the character from our world not to be the main character. I want him to be the partner. And so that was my idea. And I needed something for the main character and wanted it to be a woman, which is kind of unusual for Lit RPG. The genre tends heavily toward male readers who are interested in power fantasy and male characters, which is not to say that that's all there is. It's just that's kind of the majority. But there's room for, there's plenty of Lit RPG with female main characters and female writers too. And so he said, well, what if she was, because I said, I want it to be basically like a tabletop role-playing game. So not a computer role-playing game, but a tabletop role-playing game. And they've got classes and they level up and they do all this stuff. And that's kind of basic. So I want the characters to be what's interesting. And he said, well, what if she has a class that everyone thinks is useless unless she partners with somebody? She has to have a partner, and then that unlocks her class. And I said, okay, that works with the whole isekai thing, you know, having this kid from another world. He's not a kid, he's a young man, but he doesn't know any better, and neither does she. So he's brought to this world, and they end up partnering up without realizing that that's what's necessary. And then suddenly they're advancing really quickly, leveling up really quickly. Their skills are growing very quickly. And they gain some other companions and friends along the way and go on quests, and every book is named for the main dungeon in the book. So the book one is called Dungeon Spiteful, and that made it really easy to give titles. I am bad at coming up with titles. I hate doing it. If I could get away with saying this is that one book with people who set things on fire, I would totally do that, because it would be crazy.
Me too. Me too.
It's just easier. But doing it this way so that the dungeon is the title gives me focus. It means that every book has to have a dungeon. Every book has to have a quest of some kind. And so the War Master series is about this young woman developing the class that everyone thinks is useless. And her companion, the man from our world, who starts out by trying to get back to his own world. That's their first quest. But it turns out that the system governing the world has other plans for him. And so that's basically the series premise.
So what is the War Master class?
The War Master class is actually a tactician. War Masters perceive things about monsters that other people can't, and learns how to identify strengths and weaknesses. In later levels, she develops skills that make it possible for her to arrange a fight, like control the monsters who are attacking so that they attack a stronger foe instead of the weakest foe in the party. So in the book, as far as I've gotten now in book 7, she's actually going to lead an army, as an extension of her tactical skills.
What moron thinks this is a useless class? Cause you say, you know, that from the beginning, I'm already seeing possibilities.
Yes. The reason it's a useless class, is that in order to become these higher levels and have all these skills, you have to have someone who's your partner. And that's someone who is linked to you, and you have paired skills that are only available when you have a partner, and they advance at the same time. So in this case, she meets her companion, her partner, when she's attacked by monsters out in the middle of the wilderness, and he shows up and is helping her fight them. And at the end of the fight, she looks at her skill list, and she says, well, discern weakness. That wasn't there before. I've never seen that. And what do you mean improved assess one? It was just assess a minute ago. So most war masters don't have any of these skills because nobody wants to partner with them because they think it's useless.
That's about to change. It sounds like.
Yeah. And they do encounter a couple more war masters who accidentally figured it out for various reasons. But most of the time they'll be going through and like they'll go to, I don't know, an armorer and they're getting new armor and the guy will say, oh, you know, my son was a war master and he never found, you know, a party. They just all ignored him. So, you know, I wish he'd known what you do. And so they hear that a lot is that most war masters, in fact, her own parents said that they had a war master in their party for a little while and they didn't like him because he was always trying to tell other people their jobs. And so later on, she discovers that, well, that's because that's what his class does. And
it's literally his job or her job.
Yeah, this was this guy's job and nobody wanted to listen to him. So for her, it's accidental because she and her partner were too stupid to know that they shouldn't partner, that he shouldn't listen to her. And later ones are like there's another war master whose boyfriend wouldn't leave her when they both went out adventuring and so they fought together and that's how they figured it out. But for the most part, that's why, is because everybody assumes it's useless and they don't want to have anything to do with them.
So is the partner romantic or is it just partner as in literal companion that they fight together?
Well, they start out as just friends and it becomes romantic. Because.
But is that requirement for the class or is that just a bonus?
No, that's just because, they one of the other war masters who figures it out, it's twin brothers. And so it doesn't have to be romantic. It's just coincidental that but the thing I figure is if you've got someone that you're partnering with that you're that close to and it's someone you could be attracted to, that attraction is a natural thing to grow because you are so close. And at one point in the second book, she's thinking, you know, what happens if he doesn't fall in love with me and he falls in love with someone else? No woman wants to have her husband closely attached to a different woman. So kind of makes sense. So
we have so many questions that we don't normally get that granular in, but you got Nick and I, like the hamsters in our head are just growing in circles.
The war hamsters?
The war hamsters.
The war hamsters for the war master. Yeah.
That's right.
So, all Nick, right, you had those first?
I do. I got a two-part okay. question. The cool. first part, because this is something we usually don't talk about on the show, I've noticed. Who is the narrator? Which character in the book is the narrator of this tale?
And the main character is the woman. She's the narrator.
Okay.
The war master.
Everything is through her lens.
That's right. I don't write books except for limited third person. That's the point of view I use because I find it challenging. I find it interesting. So everything goes through her.
Okay. All right. And then the next part is what age range is this series geared towards? Are we talking young adult?
This is for adults. I like to say that older teens would appreciate it, but the audience is really adults. It's not a young adult fiction. We could talk about what young adult fiction means because for a very long time I was a literary critic specializing in fantasy literature for young adults. But so I have opinions. But
listen, the floor is yours. You can talk about whatever you want.
I will add that to a list of future episodes about what YA fiction.
Yeah, totally do that because it's
that deserves its own hour or three.
Yeah, because it's interesting. But yes.
Yeah. That and the lens of how the story is told.
Yes. Oh, that's true. How you choose to tell the story, the point of view, the focus character. Yeah, that's another good idea.
Oh, I'm gonna go back and ask like Pittman and LaVoice. I'm gonna go back to this question because I just thought about it the other day. I'm like, we never discuss the lens through which the story is told, and I think that is a very interesting question. I think that,
I agree.
That really gets you into not only the author but to the story that you're getting into.
Yeah,
you know, like Star Wars is entirely told through C-3PO.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, shocker. C-3PO. There's people that are gonna argue with me about that, and I'll die on that hill. This whole that whole Star Wars saga is told through C-3PO and R2-D2. And that people be like, no, it's Luke, it's this. And I'm like, no, dude, I've written papers in college about this. And I died on that hill. And I died with an A on top of my little grave there. But
I love it.
I enjoy that dynamic. Like, because it brings you into the author and what their thought process is. And it leads you into a different focus onto what you're reading. And I think it's really awesome because when you were telling me about this story, I was like, oh, it's the human guy that got sucked into the game. It's through his lens. But you're telling me it's through the female protagonist. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, that's different because she's not playing Earth dynamics. She's going through the rules of the world based on what she knows. And I'm like, okay, that adds a whole different layer to this story, you know, and how you read it.
Let me tell you, it is so much fun to be telling about to see our world through the point of view of someone who is talking to someone from our world as opposed to that person. So he is constantly, and they think, according to her world's rules, the only worlds other than hers are the demon worlds. And so if he's not from their world, he must be a demon. And she knows he's not a demon. He knows that. But anybody who finds out that he's not from their world will assume that he is a demon and try to kill him. And so he is constantly bringing up things from his own experience, and she's having to shut him up because he sounds like a demon from another world.
He sounds like an outcast.
Where is he from in the world?
Cincinnati.
I mean, that's basically a demon dimension.
Go Bengals.
That's right.
So does the female main character, the War Master, what's her name?
Her name is Adarin.
Adarin. Does she know that she just sees this as her world and the game mechanics are just part of living there?
Right. And it turns out that, and I can say this because it comes up at the end, but it's really not a secret. It turns out that this world that they live in is actually the prime world. And so all the other worlds around it are echoes. It's kind of like Amber, but not quite as intense. So the fact that he knows about role-playing games, that's an echo of what their world really is. Like just a piece that is remembered by our world. And so it got turned into a game in our world. And so there's all sorts of little details like that that mean that they don't think of this as a game. This is not a game. In fact, when he says, oh, well, okay, like a game. And she's like, this is not a game. What are you talking about? You're going to get killed, assuming that all this stuff is just pretend. And, but my favorite part for writing the second book is where he starts telling her the plot of Guardians of the Galaxy as they're traveling. And he's like, gradually he's like trying to figure out how can I adapt this so it fits her world, because I can't say, you know, spaceships and stuff like that. And so he'll tell her the story of the Avengers and how Captain America is actually a War Master because he's a tactician and he directs his team. And so it cracks me up reading it, and I wrote it, but it's that kind of thing that you can do when you've got a point of view character that doesn't know anything about our world. I borrowed this from the author Diana Wynne Jones, who was a young adult fantasy writer, and she was a master of describing things in our world from the perspective of someone who doesn't know anything about them. And she's really good. And so I try to emulate that. I'm not nearly as good as she was, but I try to get there.
I think time will tell, Melissa. I think time will tell.
We'll just have to see what other people think. Yeah.
So can she pick her class, or is class sort of assigned to them?
The class is assigned to her by the system. The system, basically, you when you reach a certain point, and it varies, but I know, because I wrote the book, that it's anywhere from age 18 to 22. So somewhere in that age range, you achieve a point where you get the call. And the call is an opportunity to become an adventurer, gain a class, and go out and, you know, adventure.
And I call that the pre-trial era. I explained that to my 14-year-old stepson. I'm like, dude, you're in the free trial right now. Like, that's in 4 right. years, stuff's going to get real.
That's right. Know? Yes.
So what happens if they say this adventuring life is dangerous? Screw that. I just want to, I don't know, bake pies and sell them in my town.
They either they reject the call outright, and then they do whatever they want. They're non-classed, and they can go, you know, be butchers or inn owners or whatever. Or they go adventuring for a little bit, decide that, oh, I made a mistake, I really don't want to do this, and they retire. And then they are retired adventurers. Mostly.
Go ahead. I'm a retired adventurer.
You took an arrow to the knee. So if they reject the call and they're non-classed, is that like second-class citizen in this world?
Punishment?
It's not. It depends on what you do. Well, some adventurers look at it as looking down on them. Like, oh, well, you couldn't make it. You're obviously lesser than me.
You can hack it. But you can hang.
Yeah, you couldn't do it. But a lot of people just accept that, you know, if you didn't have all these non-classed people, you wouldn't have all the amenities that adventurers come to count on. In book 5, they go to the biggest city in the north, which is a huge metropolis. And the inn that they stay at, there's the kid, the son of the innkeeper. And he's like, yeah, I don't want the call. I'm going to stay here and run the inn. And they are both, he and his father, know the city so well that they can guide Adarin and her friends. And, you know, here's where you go to eat. Here's where you stay away because they'll cheat you. Here's how you do all these things. And so Adarin, if she hadn't before, at that point would realize that shunning or looking down on people because they rejected the call is stupid. And there's also an element to, you know, you don't choose your class, it's assigned to you, but people right. believe that if they do certain things, it will influence the system. And that almost never happens. So one of the issues is, well, if you could choose your class, how many more people would accept the call? One of Adarin's companions, Isolde, wanted to be an herbalist. He thought he was going to be an alchemist, a spiritsmith. And the system made him a bard instead. And, you know, so he says, if I'd known that I was going to be a bard, I would have rejected the call because that's not what I wanted to do with my life. And of course, he's a fantastic singer and he loves music. So it's a good class for him and he learns to accept it. But, you know, that's really the issue is.
I don't know. I always thought the very bard. Go ahead, Nick.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say that's a very interesting corollary to the vet community that we have now. Because we encounter a lot of people that's like, oh, I wanted to serve. I wanted to do this. I didn't answer the call. And then you have that split amongst vets who are like, well, shut up. And then there's guys that are like, well, it's not a life for everybody. You know, so you have these like two different houses that treat the people that are like, hey, I wanted to serve. I wanted to do this, but I didn't feel like I had the right opportunity. I didn't feel like I was ready for it or whatever. And that's fine. There's a side of the community, of the vet community, that's been like, yeah, that's probably good you didn't join. It probably would have got you killed. You know, you found your own passion. You found your own route through life. Then you have the other side of like, oh, well, you know, they look down on them. I've never looked down on anybody that's like, I wanted to serve. I just didn't think it was right. You know, and I don't know, JR, like maybe you've encountered some of these same people. And I'm just like, hey, listen, I chose a life of infantry, which is a life of service, and it was a hard life. Like, my body will tell you, it screams in pain all the time because I chose this hard life. It's like being a Jedi. You know, it's a life of servitude. It's a life of stuff that you didn't really want to encounter, but you kind of did it based on a sense of service. So I try to find those corollaries in everything that I see. And I think your book shows that too. And it represents it well. There's people that didn't want to answer their game dynamic, their class, you know, and they're like, okay, well, there's people just like in the real world, there's people that are looked down on. And there's a lot of people that are like, hey man, maybe it just wasn't for you. Maybe you were meant to make baked bread, you know?
Yeah. And we need bread bakers.
Yeah, so. We do. Not everybody needs to be a grunt.
No, but we need everybody. We need all of those people. I mean, and in this world, they need both for a lot of reasons. And so, but I agree, you know, that dynamic, that sort of, do you look down on them or not, is important, but it's also realistic. You know, that's just that, you know, that's, you get that with a lot of different fields.
Well, and I think it's probably the best thing for a novelist to incorporate aspects of the real world and put them in your fantasy world, because I think that draws in the reader a bit more, you know, because we all deal with those types of things, like the person we're meant to be and the person we're supposed to be. Right. And I think it's a very interesting dichotomy, and I want to dig deeper into this world. And well, apparently I'm a couple of books behind. I'm a couple of books behind, apparently, which adds to the library.
So question for you quickly. You mentioned you're writing book 7. Book 2 is out. Book 3, I think, is on pre-order. How fast are you writing these dang things?
Oh, I write pretty fast. I mean, not super fast. The Lit RPG community is actually made up of many very fast writers. It takes me about 6 to 7 weeks to write a book.
How many words a day?
That's pretty fast.
Yeah, it is pretty fast. I aim for about 4,000 words a day. I don't always make
Jesus
it.
Jesus Christ!
Well, but this is all I do. She's slow. This is my job, and I can get that 4,000 words in about 3 hours.
Yeah, but so, there's other professional novelists out there that take months to complete a story.
Yeah,
you know, and slow. You're over here just speedballing it, which is amazing. So, what's the secret here?
I plan.
Is it crack? Is it monster?
No.
Is it tea?
I have bipolar disorder, so occasionally I'm manic, and then it just goes really fast. But no, that's mostly under control with drugs, so I don't have those wild mood swings, which is very fortunate. But,
so what you're saying is, you're like a dog with a bone. Once you have it, you have to keep going.
Yes. That's exactly right. Okay. And so I get an idea planned out. The current book turned out to need to be divided in half. So
was it too long? Is that why you had to split it in half?
There was too much story in it. So length is not really the issue. The issue was I was trying to cram too many things into one volume, and that just wasn't working.
It was a pacing issue.
Yeah, it would have felt really long if I had done it that way.
Right.
So I cut it in half. But I say cut it in half. It's not written, so I didn't like divide it after it was written. But so I divided it into two stories. And that means that for book 7, I know the whole book. I have the entire plot, which means it's just a matter of sitting down and writing every day.
As an author for writing these stories, do you think that was the right choice to break it into two halves?
Okay. Yeah, I was fighting it, and I was talking, in fact, to the same friend who introduced me to Lit RPG. And I said, you know, I feel like I just, it's going to be so long. It just keeps being added. And I said, maybe I should cut it in half, but I don't think so. And he said, no, you know, I think you've got a good point. And he laid out a couple of reasons why it would make a good, two books make sense. And I'm like, I don't know. And then I thought about it some more, and I thought, you know, he was right. And then I did that, and it was like I felt this enormous weight off my chest that I had finally made the right decision. So I think I think it will be better for it. And it's not like, you know, not like I have to cap the series at 8 books or whatever. There will be an end. It's not going to be an endless series, but
right,
it will be as long as it needs to be.
Well, that's good. I mean, a lot of authors, I mean, probably don't have the foresight to like, hey man, I wrote maybe a little bit too much and it could be a second mm-hmm. story or, you know, mm-hmm. throw it on the other end and make it a separate story. So, yeah. I mean, kudos to you as an author for doing that, because a lot of people don't do that. They just want to throw everything in the barrel.
Yeah.
So I've been guilty of that myself.
Yeah.
So what class is the Earth character and what is his name?
His name is Owen and he is a Swordsworn. Owen.
And what is a Swordsworn?
A Swordsworn is a master of the sword. So they have several martial classes. There's staff sworn, so you fight with blunt weapons. Sword sworn, you fight with edged weapons. A Deadeye is an archer and a ranger. No, the ranger is a pathseer. I forgot.
Rangers.
So, yes, the pathseer becomes there. There's an interesting pathseer in book 3 and 4 that I'm really proud of. And staff sworn, sword sworn, Deadeye. Lone Wolf, Swift Hands is a monk. I basically went through and wrote down as many D&D classes as I could and then gave them all funny names that were unique.
That's cool. So we normally do this sooner, but we got distracted by all the shiny things about this world that are why Nick and I are nerds.
All the shiny things. So awesome. Yeah,
so this is the second book cover, so let me go to the first one. Mm-hmm. And so this is the first cover. I like, before Nick does his artistic breakdown, I like that it looks like a pastel matte painting mm-hmm. as opposed to the standard like AI graphic art look. I'm not saying AIs are making them, but that graphic art style is very popular. Mm-hmm. I like the matte painting effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the artist, the design company I work with offered me the first choice. And I'm like, it's beautiful, but it really feels like it's generated. It doesn't feel right. Do you have any other options? And so they came back to me and said, well, okay, here's some samples. Which one do you like? And I picked one and they said, okay, well, we'll let this guy do it. And he was so enthusiastic when it got to like book 2, I think, that he didn't communicate with them for some reason. They were like a holiday or something. So he actually tracked me down to ask me if I was okay with some change that he needed to make. And so I think he's really great. Now I have issues with this cover, but I want to hear what Nick has to say.
Are you sure?
It's, I don't know, because it's a little too late to change it. So, yeah. You know, there is that, but I'm always interested in...
Well, here's my honest assessment of this cover. Mm-hmm. It is, artistically, it's brilliantly done. It's done well. Mm-hmm. What I don't get from this cover is tension. And that's what sells books. You have to have a cover that has tension to it. You need to have danger towards your central character, which is represented here in the bottom left corner for those of us that are actually watching it and not listening it. Artistically, it's brilliantly done. The anatomy's good. The sword's good. The position's good. You have the background going on there. I don't know what's happening. I don't know why I should care about what's happening behind her. So that's the issue I have. There's no tension. There's nothing to draw me into the danger. You know?
Is she missing the other covers?
No. I love that you said that, because that is exactly the issue I have with this. And here's,
thank God. Okay, so we meet on Thursdays. I got booze. We'll drink
this. Oh yeah. This is okay. So I told them what I wanted. I should have let the artist have his way, you know, I mean, not his way, but like let him have his head, just go do what he wanted. So I gave them this and I got it back and I thought, you know, it's beautiful. There's something wrong. And so I wanted them to add the flaming door outline. And
I see the door. There, I see the door outline.
See, that's what he added. And I thought, okay, I can't fight this anymore. I'm just going to take what he gives me. And so it isn't until the second cover that I really am pleased with with what happened. But that's, and see the little skull pile, you know, there's a lot of little details, but it doesn't really, it's not dangerous. Active. Yeah, you know, it doesn't. And the thing is that, but that's exactly, I totally agree. And you, so this, you could, this represents.
There's a quick change that he could have done.
Yes.
He could have thrown whatever the adversary is, and even if you just like foreshadowed it, like in a shadow, mm-hmm. encasing over that hut.
The other thing you
there's
can't
so
see,
many things you could have done.
There's the other thing you can't see is that there is a skull in the trees behind the War Master title. So the original painting, actually, you can kind of see it a little bit. It? It's right in the center, but it was very subtle. So the original art, and I wish I had, I don't have the art for this one. I have the original art for the second and third covers.
I would love to see it without the letterhead on there.
Yeah, I don't have that. Because,
but it feels like he was, the artist was like 75% there.
Yes.
Conveying danger. Yeah. Like, and the pose of the central character, mm-hmm. like that was a setup. Like, mm-hmm. like she's got the sword up. She's ready to engage. So there is danger nearby, but we don't get to see the danger. So we missed that 25% of why I should care, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to another cover, man.
And that's why I, in the second one, gave them a background and said, here's the images, here's the elements. And it is less representative of the actual scene. The first book, and this is the kiss of death that I should have known better in that first cover, is the cover needs to sell the book. It is not meant to illustrate a scene.
That is a hard thing to learn.
That was a hard thing to
learn.
It's a
hard balance. I know that.
And so I should have known better, but this is the second cover.
I love this one a lot more.
I love this color more. This cover, mm-hmm.
yeah,
because
me too.
There's tension, there's danger. Mm-hmm. You have this dragon looking thing that's coming after the protagonist, mm-hmm. or the central character. Like it feels like there's stakes involved, and that's what I was missing, mm-hmm. from the first one. And like I said, it was a simple fix. You could throw a shadow of what, mm-hmm. the danger could possibly be, whether it had to do anything with the story or not is irrelevant.
Oh, exactly. And so I take the blame for the first cover because he did exactly what I told him to. And I consider it my responsibility to tell him otherwise. And so I didn't, and that's okay. We'll live with that and we'll learn. I kind of wish I'd known you were, remembered, because I knew you were going to do this, but I'd forgotten. And I would have sent the third cover as well, for you to look at, but, I forgot. So
no, this is a great cover. Like, and here's the thing: when you start doing a series of stuff, like, mm-hmm. your first cover might not hit the mark, mm-hmm. but your second one or your third one will, and that'll draw you in, because most authors put like, "Hey, this is a sequel to these series here," and you're like, "Okay, well, the cover didn't really razzle or dazzle me, you know, so I'll go back and check those out, even though I didn't really like the cover art," which is fine. You know, never judge a book by its cover unless, mm-hmm. you have to. Mm-hmm. So like Winter's Peril, that's a great cover. Like there's, mm-hmm. so much tension going on there where it draws me in, even though I don't know anything about what's going on there. I'm like, mm-hmm. all right, maybe I'll read to this point in this story that's going to draw me in through the author.
Yeah.
So I think this cover is brilliant. It's great. And it was from the same author, or same artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same artist.
So the one, there's always the chance you could recover it and tweak it and go back to it. But you broke the cardinal rule of RPGs.
Oh yeah.
You know what you did?
What?
She's wearing functional clothing. Everyone knows she's wearing the chainmail bikini.
She's
wearing a coat.
Women don't get cold. That never happens.
Oh no, of course not. Heaven forbid.
They love their chainmail bikinis.
Oh, and the cover image, because they have me give them reference images, because English is not his first language, and so he works better from like pictures and things. And so I found the coat that she's wearing online for sale. And I'm like, oh, I would wear this coat. I wonder, oh, it's $300. I do not love it $300 worth.
Yeah, I don't love that much. I mean, I loved it when it was affordable to me, but now that I saw the price tag, not so much.
Not anymore. Yeah.
So
anymore.
Now that, given that you're a gamer yourself, you know, you grew up on the Dyson and pen and paper. Mm-hmm. Have you incorporated any of this into your campaigns?
I have. I have. In fact, we ran a scenario. I'm currently running a fifth edition kind of campaign. It's meant to fill in the gaps when not everybody is available for our main campaign. And okay. So it's made to be flexible, and the adventures are not interrelated. They're loosely connected. And so I ran a scenario where they were in the frozen wasteland, and they were supposed to be attacked by swarm monsters. And so I restatted a roach swarm to be ice roaches, which is one of the monsters in Winter's Peril. And nice. So I pulled that out. I would love to, well, I wanted to do this with Company of Strangers as well. It would be so much fun to play a game using the classes and things that I came up with. But
you know, doing that is kind of difficult.
Yeah, it's and designing a whole system is not something that interests me. So, yeah. Anyway,
I've been voluntold to do one, but we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
So, all right. So, I really do like these covers. I can't wait to see more. You're up to book seven. Is book seven, you're writing it right now, or it's with the editor right now?
No, I'm writing book seven. Book four is with the editor. She assures me that it will be done very soon, but she's had a really busy week. So it's Jana. Okay. Jana is my editor.
Because that girl doesn't need more work. She never sleeps.
Yeah. She's so busy.
She's overwhelmed and busy and does
but she loves it.
Great work anyway.
So is there anything about, I mean, I almost think, Nick, we gotta do this as like a book review episode.
I think this needs to be like a two or three parter because it's a huge world that we got to dive into.
We're gonna have to find out an angle because I want to know more, but we're at the hour and 15 mark and Stabby is sending both of us messages. She's cooked dinner and we know she gets stabby when the food starts getting cold.
So. Oh, yes.
I love Melissa, but I'm not getting stabbed over anything.
No.
You should put a stabby cook in your book. Like they go to the inn and they don't eat the food while it's hot, and she just
like dinner is served. I said right now.
Okay, I have an idea now.
So, is there anything that we didn't cover to give people the basics that they would need to know to enjoy this book that you want to give them, like the last minute sales pitch?
This is lit RPG that's accessible for non-lit RPG readers. I presented it to my ARC team, and a lot of them were very hesitant because this is not a genre they read a lot of. And many of them came back and said, this was really great. I loved this. I'm ready to read more. So I think it's accessible for people who don't necessarily read this genre or are gamers or anything like that. I think I've made it interesting for people who aren't the core audience.
Nice. That's a hard thing to do.
It really is. Potential for, is there an audiobook version coming out on these books?
There is. I am having problems with the distributor listing it on Audible. And the audiobook does exist for book one and two. Book three is currently with the narrator. I have a daughter who is dyslexic and loves reading, but audiobooks are the only way she can read. And so I'm doing this mainly as a gift to her because she loves the series. So yes, they are available on audio. They are available in most audio platforms, including Spotify, and just not on Audible yet. And I don't have time to figure out what's going on there until like I need a couple of weeks before I can go into that, but I'm kind of mad because it means I'm losing sales.
So who is the narrator? Do you know off the top of your head?
The narrator is Talon David. Talon, like a eagle's claw, Talon David.
Okay.
And she's great. She captured Owen's voice perfectly. I was just thrilled. So.
Okay. So that is good to know, because I tend to do audiobooks too with the with the traumatic brain injury. Sometimes, you know, I just don't have the brain power to focus on the screen. I can write the words or I can read the words. I can't do both, but audiobooks gives me the opportunity to do both. Mm-hmm. So I'm there with you. So do you have it? You don't have any idea when they're going to fix that?
I have no idea. It's a Findaway Voices problem. Findaway is the distributor, and they've been having a lot of issues lately.
You should.
Among which is like problems with their rights grab and things like that. So I either have to tackle them or find a different distributor who can get me into Audible. And I'm busy these next couple of weeks, so it's going to be a little while.
Understood. All right. Well, this is the part of the introduction or the interview, dear listener, not the introduction. We're way past that, where I remind you to please be kind and speak your mind on the reviewing platforms. Your reviews help the right readers find the right books. So do your part. It really does help get the word out to other readers. It helps the author know, hey, people like this. Let me keep doing it. So it's the part you play as a consumer of the product to keep what you like going. With that being said, Melissa, how can listeners and viewers find you on the Wild Wild interwebs?
My website is melissamcshanewrites.com. And you can find me on Facebook. I have a readers group as well as a Facebook page. And I'm also on Twitter, although I don't really tweet very much. But I am reachable that way. There's also a contact form on my website if you want to reach out and say hi.
Now it's not Twitter, it's X. So are you Xing?
I'm X. I don't know. What do you do anymore? My husband is always the one saying it's X now. You should say X. And I'm like, I don't think
so. When you Twitter, you tweet.
I still say Twitter.
But it's your tweet. Too. So Xing you, I don't know.
If you get two. You know what? I don't even want to get onto an X scale because that gets us our family-friendly rating out the window. So right. We're just going to move on. And I will remind you that you can find us, dear listener, on our Linktree at linktr.ee, linktr.ee/Blasters and Blades Podcast. Again, linktr.ee/Blasters and Blades Podcast, where we link to all the things, the bit shoots, the rumbles, the YouTubes, the Twitters, our email, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com, our Facebook group and Facebook page. And most importantly, we can reach Madam Stabby Stab on Instagram, Twitter, and email. And if you wanted more from this episode, it's her fault because she has the knife out right now and we're all afraid. So with that, you can also find us more directly on our website at anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades. Again, anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades, where for as little as 99 cents a month, you can help keep the lights on. Every penny helps. And if you want to support the show more directly, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Again, buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Be sure to put in the comment section that it's for the podcast. And I promise I will keep my co-hosts duly caffeinated. They will drink until it pours out of their eyeballs. And if you want to support the show, one more way that we mention every time, we are affiliate sponsors with Coffee Brand Coffee. They have coffee, tea, hot chocolate, snacks, merch, cups, caps. You know, they got the stuff.
They got it all, man.
All you got to do is click the link below and use the code PODCASTGRUNTS for 10% off, and we get a little bit of a kickback. So it's a win-win. You help the show, and you get duly caffeinated. What's not to like? All right, Nick, I understand you've got to go eat before she kills you, so I'm going to say thank you for spending some of your precious time with us. For my crazy co-host, I am J.R. Hanley, and this was the Blasters and Blades Podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time, where we'll indulge our love of nerd culture, cheesy jokes, and all things that go boom. And with that, I'm going to hit the